catechism, with particular interest in the history and culture of religions, both popular and official, in the 19th and 20th centuries. As I mentioned, he is currently assistant professor of religious studies and American studies here at UVA. Prior to coming to Charlottesville, he held postdoctorate positions at the Center for the Study of Religion at Princeton and in the Lilly Fellows Program at Valparaiso University. Matt's main areas of teaching and research are religious liberalism, the cultures and politics of pluralism, religion and race, and print culture. His first book, Seeking a Spiritual Center, Books, Book Culture, and Liberal Religion in Modern America, explores the role of consumer culture, religious liberalism, and print media in the rise of spiritual cosmopolitanism in the 20th century. This book will be published by Oxford sometime in the spring, I guess. It just sounds so interesting. I can't wait to read it. You're also beginning, Matt, a new book project on race and the search for religious authenticity from the Civil War to the 1960s. It's a pleasure having you here this morning. Welcome.
It's great to be here. Thanks. And this is my first project event, and as a non-theologian, Manuel, you're not alone here. I'm a historian. I was uncertain, you know, what this would mean, what this would bring. But yesterday's conversations, this morning's conversations, have more than put me at ease. And I say that partly because I find myself in a sort of a favorite position here, kind of one foot in and one foot out. I think that's always a productive place to be in any kind of conversation. In this case, what it means is I'm still totally puzzled by lived theology. I mean, by theology in general, but by this sort of lived theology category that we're dealing with here. And I think that's good. I mean, I'm puzzled in a way that means I'm hooked, right? But I'm a bit more at home as a historian with the idea of the lived. Yesterday, someone mentioned the sort of odd hostility to real religion, that was a phrase yesterday, among certain kinds of theologians, and that resonated with me because I've always tried to maintain a real generosity towards real religion or sort of ordinary religion. In this, I have been greatly influenced by scholars that have been mentioned, Robert Orsi, for my work especially, Lee Schmidt, but it's also autobiographical. Real religion for me is my parents and my grandparents. To such a degree, I'm talking about preachers, I'm talking about missionaries in the Congo, I'm talking about tongue speakers, I'm talking about people who pray for parking spaces at the mall, right? I mean, real religion. Anything other than generosity, and I really mean this, to me would seem like a kind of act of betrayal, really, in a pretty serious way, even though the folks I study are often very different than sort of me and my family. My work is historical, as I said, and it's descriptive. It's not intended to be constructive or normative in any kind of direct way, but I think it's still, I hope anyway, it's still pervaded by this sense of generosity. And so to begin, I'll read a paper here. And I have sort of two goals with this. One is to give just a little bit of taste of my work, sort of book project that I'm finishing. The other is to think in a very rudimentary way about history and how history can fit into or inform conversations about lived theology and the relationship between history and ethnography. So I have not read over 10 books in my entire lifetime, wrote a man from Missouri, Mr. R.E. Ault, to a famed New York preacher. And I thank God that this was one of them. I intend to read it again and again until I get the full meaning. I needed this book desperately, as I have wondered how and when I would ever find God. For a long time, I did not believe, and no matter how hard I tried, I could not honestly believe and have faith. Of course, your book has been invaluable in helping me. Accounts like this from a piece of fan mail written in 1960 are vital to my research on religion and reading in the mid-20th century. Drawing on reception theory and literary and media studies and on the burgeoning fields of the history of books and reading, I try to understand the role of books, the book business, and the practice of reading in shaping spirituality. I'm particularly interested in the way the marketplace of reading fostered the spread of liberal, psychological, and mystical vocabularies of faith in the mid-20th century, and the way those vocabularies functioned as an American middle-class lingua franca. In order to do this, I study book clubs, book promotion and advertising, publishing, authorship, and as much as possible, actual readers. So I'm interested in the kind of the material conditions of reading. Literary scholar Janice Radway pioneered the ethnographic study of readers nearly 30 years ago in her celebrated Reading the Romance, a study of the women who read romance novels. Radway conducted her research through the standard tools of ethnography, interviews, and participant observation. As a historian, I cannot utilize these ethnographic methods, but I aim, nevertheless, to employ an ethnographic sensibility, meaning, in particular, an attentiveness to the experiences of ordinary men and women and to the particularities of those experiences, especially when they are found to be at odds with larger narratives, paradigms, or political or academic agendas. Radway's readers of Harlequin novels challenged, received feminist and literary assumptions. And the readers of popular religious literature, as I've encountered them in the archive, similarly challenge theological, disciplinary, and political orthodoxies of church and academy. This ethnographic sensibility has demanded that I take the acts of reading I find in the archive seriously as religious practice. Middle-class Americans of the mid-20th century related to books not only as readers of texts, nor simply as consumers of a marketed commodity, but also quite often as religious actors acting religiously. The piety of reading, setting aside a designated time for disciplined attention, reading and rereading contemplatively, underlining and note-taking, book talk with friends, family, or fellow book club members is an embodied devotional practice as well as an intellectual engagement with words and ideas. Reading is material. It is embodied and it is shaped by material and economic and political realities like advertising, like library collection practices, like the political economy of reviews. So work like mine must attend to wider historical context. Only in the 19th and 20th centuries, after all, did the economic, cultural, social, and religious forces align to make the consumption of mass market books a part of everyday spiritual practice. And nowhere was this revolution in religious life more pronounced than in the United States. In the critical decades after World War I, which is where my work is really centered, institutional, commercial, cultural, and religious transformations facilitated an ever greater engagement of religion and the book business. For a reader to have a life-changing religious experience happen in and through a mass market commodity, a heavily advertised paperback book in the case of Mr. Alt that I opened with, was a phenomenon made possible by 20th century consumer culture and the way it structured religious life and practice. Reading religiously, though a practice with deep roots in the history of religion, took on new forms and meanings in the context of consumer culture. The Quaker historian, philosopher, and activist Rufus Jones understood better than most the possibilities and pitfalls of the modern book marketplace. To promote a national program known as Religious Book Week, Jones wrote in the spring of 1921 a brief article called The Habit of Reading, intended to initiate his readers into the mysteries of earnest religious reading and book buying. He began by lamenting the poor reading habits of most Americans. It's always a sort of a safe place to start. And yet he noted with the recent expansion in religious publishing and the book business, and it did undergo a tremendous revolution right after World War I, there exists today within the reach of everybody who can read a very remarkable assortment of transforming and enlightening books. But Jones aimed not only to make his readers aware of important new religious books, but also to advocate particular ways of reading those books, and particular ways, in fact, of relating to the entire marketplace of books. It is not enough to read capriciously and sporadically, to borrow a book occasionally and then have done with it, he argued. I am pleading for the ownership of books and for the cultivation of the habit of reading. Proper religious reading for Jones meant reading in a very specific manner. The true and effective way to read an enlightening book, he counseled, is to read it pencil in hand, to mark cardinal passages, to make notes, to digest the message which the book contributes. Jones then added, just to make sure this was perfectly clear, that means the book ought, if possible, to be owned rather than borrowed. Book buying might, incidentally, through the laws of supply and demand, stimulate the writing of more and better religious books. But for Jones, the primary benefit of proper book reading and buying was personal. One must own religious books because one needs to go back again and again to a good book, to reread marked passages, and to become literally possessed of it. A good book can possess us, in other words, only if we first possess it. Many 20th century religious readers understood Rufus Jones's reading advice, even if they had never heard of Rufus Jones. For such advice was deeply rooted in American religious culture. And I find examples like this just all through the archives of readers, you know, saying, I wanted to get your book from the library, but then I decided that wasn't good enough because I wanted to tear it apart and underline it and mark it up, and so I had to buy it. I've seen this just countless times. So when Jones stated that the proper way to read was pencil in hand, to go back again and again to a good book, he presented modern Americans with old advice about how to read. 19th century evangelicals spent considerable energy trying to persuade Americans to read in just this way. They worked tirelessly not only to write, produce, and distribute books, but also to educate American readers about how to read those books. And in the process, they established an ideology of reading religiously that continued to exert great influence well into the 20th century, as Rufus Jones, as Mr. Alt indicate. 19th century print culture shared with the Protestantism that sparked it a democratizing impulse rooted in the ideology of the priesthood of all believers. This impulse led in the vastly expanded world of print to what one might call a priesthood of all readers, a situation ripe for religious turmoil rooted in interpretive chaos, right? What the hell is going to happen when we get all these books out into the hands of everybody and they're going to make of it what they will? This is a situation ready for chaos. As a result, religious readers devised ideologies of proper reading, strategies for vulnerable readers to navigate these uncharted and potentially treacherous waters. Noah Porter, the president of Yale College, opened his widely reprinted 1870 reading guide, Books and Reading, or What Books Shall I Read and How Shall I Read Them? It's always nice when there's just like this very honest title, right? He opened this book with an extended image of a savage, his words, brought to London. This is 1870, right? Of all the wonders of civilization, including museums, cathedrals, and factories, Porter mused, books would prove the most mysterious and incomprehensible to this imagined visitor. The thought experiment of the savage in London demonstrated to Porter that books contained the essential power of Christian civilization itself. No force nor influence can undo the work begun by those few pages, Porter exhorted. No love of father or mother, no temptation of money or honor, no fear of suffering or disgrace is an overmatch for the enchantment conjured up and sustained by an exciting volume. I wish my students believed this, right? Therefore, Porter continued, we ought to select our books, above all our favorite books, with a more jealous care than we choose our friends and intimates, and read those books in the prayerful and attentive manner befitting their sacred power. George Philip Piles, author of another 19th century reading guide, echoed Porter's exhortations and added more practically that each worthwhile book should be read four times in order, in his words, to master and use it, not only to swallow it, but to make it part of ourselves and thereby strengthen all our powers. And if you notice, in the material I've quoted, we've come across a number of eating metaphors for reading. I mean, think about reading as an embodied practice, the pervasiveness of these eating metaphors for reading when people talk about reading religiously is really remarkable. And I mean, I think this goes back, right? Aren't there examples of this? People who know their Bible better than I do, and both in Hebrew scriptures and in Christian scriptures, right? Of God commanding or angels commanding people to eat the scrolls. I think this is very old. And just talking to a colleague, I know in Islamic practices, there are examples of people eating the Quran, certain passages of the Quran, for healing or for other kinds of purposes. So I think this is actually a really powerful idea, this sort of metaphor of eating, of digestion, of rumination, of savoring, right? Incorporation. When read in such a way, in this serious, intense, prayerful, gustatory way, the printed word would touch a human soul as a means of divine grace. This idea, so utterly foreign to modern theorists of reading, rested, writes the historian David Nord, on the belief that the meaning of a text resides entirely in the text, and that the text is hegemonic. Prayerful reading would eliminate the anarchic possibilities inherent in both Protestant doctrine and the emerging mass media and allow the reader direct access to sacred, timeless truths. Evangelicals such as Porter and Piles believed the modes of sacred reading they cherished were losing ground to what they called shallow or passive reading. This debate persisted throughout the 20th century in various guises, secular and religious, as critics came to see the shallow reading that so vexed 19th century Jeremiah's as but one of the myriad vices of American consumer culture. I think there's no better example of consumerist reading practices than what we do as academics, like just right, zip through something. What do I need to get out of this? All right, on to the next thing. Theologian Paul Griffiths of Duke, for example, contrasts religious reading, in his words, as a lover reads, with a tensil attentiveness that wishes to linger, to prolong, to savor, with consumer reading, which wants to extract what is useful or exciting or entertaining from what is read, preferably with dispatch, all in the quick orgasm of consumption. Just as 19th century tract writers believed a good religious text to be hegemonic, its meaning plain to any attentive reader, Griffiths asserts the basic metaphors of reading religiously are those of discovery, uncovering, retrieval, opening up. Religious readers read what is there to be read, and what is there to be read always precedes, exceeds, and in the end supersedes its readers. Griffith's stark divide between religious and consumerist modes of reading echoes the concerns of Porter and the other 19th century evangelicals that I mentioned. This continued concern throughout the 19th and 20th century reveals an abiding conviction in the power of the printed word to mold character and faith for good or ill. Americans reading religiously in the 20th century were deeply formed by these notions of proper reading practice, and yet also read in an environment profoundly shaped by the destabilizing centrifugal force of consumer capitalism, in which the desires of the consumer reign supreme. So recognizing how reading has been structured by both evangelical and consumerist sensibilities has forced me to move away from an evaluation of texts as strictly bearers of ideas. Though ideas surely do matter, I'm sort of tempted to say, even in religion. And toward a more holistic account of reading as a material religious practice. Such a move decenters theological concerns about orthodoxy and heterodoxy, and cultural concerns about high and low, which are so sort of pervasive in any kind of assessment of literature, and instead calls attention to religion as lived in the everyday. Here, the ethnographic demand to listen to ordinary religious actors becomes paramount. Mr. Ault, for example, again, my opening example, found God after much desperate longing by reading Norman Vincent Peale's The Power of Positive Thinking. a book universally despised, right, by both secular and ecclesiastical critics as intellectually and theologically vapid, if not downright pernicious. Yet Alt's reading of The Power of Positive Thinking was far from anomalous. Letters to Rabbi Joshua Loth Liebman, author of a 1946 bestseller, Peace of Mind, reveal similarly powerful reading experiences. And getting into the Liebman archive was one of the real highlights of my research, because there were literally thousands of letters from readers in there. I won't cite all of them, but just an example or two. So this is a book called Peace of Mind in 1946, right? A middle-aged high school teacher wrote to Liebman, "I read all of your book twice, and some parts of it several times. I found much help in it, but then added, although some of it is too deep for me to understand." So this is a high school teacher reading a book that, you know, is dismissed as kind of popular fluff, right? Saying, but too deep for me to understand. I need to keep wrestling with it. "My husband works 18 hours a day," wrote another woman named Lillian after reading Peace of Mind. "With only 4 years of education, married at age 20, now a housewife and a mother," she confided to Rabbi Liebman. "Therefore, I am a very lonely woman. And since I have two children and have to do my own babysitting, I have resorted to reading." "Dear Rabbi, words just couldn't express what reading has done for me. It has given me insight into the world around me." Accounts such as these must remain central to our understanding of religious reading, but also to our assessments of larger cultural and religious dynamics. Historians such as Jackson Lears and Christopher Lash, sociologists like Robert Bella and Philip Reif, and many other social critics have described, documented, and generally lamented the rise of a therapeutic culture in the 20th century, which is typically connected to the ascendancy of a pervasive consumerism and the decline of Protestant understandings of the self. Therapeutic culture, these critics contend, aimed for the adjustment of the individual to the social structures as given, and thus made no allowance and provide no resources for any kind of penetrating social critique. The great inspirational bestsellers of the mid-20th century then, especially those with psychological or kind of positive thinking orientations, such as Peale's or Liebman's, and they're actually very different books, but I'm just kind of putting them together here for convenience sake, seem prime evidence of just this sort of religious decline. And the kind of spirituality represented in these texts, according to the critics, represents the final stage of the modernization of soul care, the ultimate victory of therapeutic consumerism over redemptive religion. Now, this criticism has many useful insights. Therapeutic culture often has led to political quiescence and consumerist hedonism. But our framework must recognize the slippage between structures of domination and particular human responses to dominant cultures, such as those revealed by ethnography or an ethnographically informed history. In the arena of lived religion, according to Robert Orsi, possibilities for openness, innovation, and resistance exist within structures of power. Orsi sees lived religion as a site of resistance and domination, of autonomy and hegemony. In his description of the transgressive possibility of lived religion, and these are his words, "the sacred is reconceptualized as the place not simply where things happen, but where the circulations of power short-circuit." And yet, recognizing that religion as practice so often defies simple either-ors, he calls for a simultaneous exploration of the ways that religious idioms are themselves deeply, subtly, but inevitably implicated in strategies of social and psychological discipline. So, Norman Vincent Peale might indeed have promoted a businessman's gospel that reified capitalism, consumerism, and therapeutic adjustment to the status quo. But Mr. Alt, nevertheless, found in Peale's writing a life-changing understanding of God. The social history of reading, in fact, closely aligns with Orsi's articulation of lived religion. Since, as historian of reading, David Hall states, it is a truism of the new reading history that readers remake the text. The ethnographic sensibility inherent in both lived religion and the new reading history approaches, really their sort of shared determination to see individual agency in the midst of structures, narratives, paradigms, asks us as scholars to look for religion where it happens, even if that happening occurs in embarrassingly ordinary, low, or uncouth places. Mr. Ault's reading of a subliterary inspirational bestseller stands akin in this way to the Catholic pilgrims who flock to a replica of Lourdes in the Bronx, as Orsi has studied, or to the Protestant admirers of Warner Salmon's famed Head of Christ, as David Morgan has studied, or indeed to any of the countless examples of religion as embedded in the occurrences of everyday life. And I pair these examples, sort of Protestant and Catholic examples, because I think it's important to apply the lived religion approaches, this sort of generosity to real religion, not just to the exotic cases, right? Not just to the penitentes sort of hanging themselves on a cross or something like this, but also to the ordinary and banal, such as middle-class Americans reading an inspirational bestseller. Once theological concerns about orthodoxy and heterodoxy and cultural concerns about high and low recede, large arenas of American cultural and religious life open to view. Many writers to Peel, for example, reflected simply but profoundly on the struggles of life and of the help Peel's writings afforded. Dear Dr. Peel, a letter begins from a woman in a small town in Indiana in 1953. For some time, I've wanted to write you and tell you how much your books have helped me. Without them and some other literature on the same order, I sometimes wonder how I would have gotten through the past 2 years. She then told Peel of her husband's death, her struggle to care for 3 children under the age of 7, all while juggling her own college education and the care of an aged grandmother. There are hundreds of letters like this. This is probably the most common kind of letter that I came across in the archives. It's sort of, let me tell you about the struggles of my life and how your book helped me make it through. The most heartbreaking thing just about that I've ever read was a letter to Rabbi Liebman. And Liebman had a chapter on guilt and a chapter on grief. And a woman wrote him and said, I was giving my toddler a bath, and I left the room and came back, and she was dead. And I wanted to kill myself. I decided right there, the only thing I can do is kill myself. And in your book, and particularly your chapters on guilt and grief, you saved my life, right? And then we did, well, this is popular inspirational literature, this is junk, this is, you know, how can you still think that after reading a letter like this? Other letters to Peel offer windows into the social and cultural climate of mid-century, such as a writer seeking advice about a minstrel show planned for an upcoming church fundraiser. My personal reaction, Peel replied, is that there is no humor more genuine than that of the Negro race. Don't worry about this, you know, enjoy the minstrel show. 1950s America, right? Still other writers reveal the increasingly eclectic nature of American spirituality in the post-war years. This is what I want to close with. Peel received letters from Jews, as Liebman did from Christians, reflecting the emergence of a thriving interfaith culture in post-war America. While a writer from Los Angeles, and this is not atypical, moved even farther afield, this letter writer recommended to Peel the popular Autobiography of a Yogi by Swami Paramahansa Yogananda. It's a big seller, I think, going back to the 30s. Since its discussion of spirit visitation, the writer noted, closely paralleled Peel's own published account of a visitation he had received from his deceased mother. For more than a century at the elite level, and for at least a generation by mid-20th century at the popular level, Americans had used the mass market of print to explore beyond their native traditions of faith. And it seems to me that a real challenge for lived religion, and maybe particularly for lived theology, is to examine and to really take seriously the fluidity of religious life across the boundaries that official religion uses to demarcate traditions. Right? Theology happens across those boundaries all the time. From these instances of market-facilitated religious eclecticism, in fact, I think we can readily comprehend a lot of American religious life of the late 20th and 21st centuries. We can understand the move in post-war popular religious culture to figures like Jack Kerouac or George Harrison. Later in the century, to someone like Deepak Chopra, to the immense celebrity of the Dalai Lama. The ubiquitous yoga centers full of Jewish and Protestant and Catholic Americans in strip malls across America. Popular religion in America thoroughly intermeshed with the ubiquitous and inescapable culture of consumerism regularly violates boundaries of creed and tradition. And this rich, fertile mess, I think, is critical to understanding theology as lived in America. I know the book. I haven't really sort of spent a lot of time with it.
It really connects to what you're saying, because she takes especially three genres that are controversial in the academy and popular culture.
Mm-hmm.
And talks about how the women use this not just for survival, but to find these redemptive elements. One's gangsta lit and misery lit, and then Christian self-help.
Uh-huh.
I'm doing for the past 2 years is directing and teaching an academic theology program in a women's prison. And so it's really pushed me to kind of challenge my assumptions.
Yeah. Right. The Shack. Yeah, absolutely. The Secret.
So there's a really interesting history of reading the prison as well.
Yeah. And of course that's, literally policed, right? There's no such. It's censored in all kinds of ways.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you, that's the book that's on the shelf that I need to actually sit down with some more. Yeah. Yeah.
Because they're small and carry books. So that's something about poverty and the materiality of books. That just being small is what they need.
I was going to bring some show and tell with me, and I just didn't have the time. But I've got a collection of books, Armed Services Edition books, that were produced during the Second World War, and they're designed. They were run on the same presses that produced. Phone books, it's like a page of the phone book cut in half. And so they're all printed with two columns. They're unabridged, but they're cheap. The military actually gave them away. But their dimensions are designed to fit in the pocket of a service uniform, right? So it's the same exact thing that to understand engagement with a text, oftentimes you actually need to really understand the material form of the object. Yeah. Yeah.
To try and control that. And then also I'm very interested to see they're in Walmart, right? I go to Walmart and
absolutely.
It now looks like they put the Christian bookstores out of business.
Yeah.
Just
well, I mean, that's a story that's extremely important in religious publishing, but it's really a story across all media. I mean, you see this in radio. There were ways in which the liberal Protestants controlled radio they were required to have by the government, what they called kind of sustaining time, so certain hours of the day devoted to religious programming, and these were always given over to people like Harry Emerson Fosdick from the Riverside Church, or, you know, sort of powerful, connected liberal Protestants. So the evangelicals and fundamentalists just said, well, to hell with you, we'll just create our own radio networks, right? And went and did it in such fabulously successful ways that then when the kind of network radio got out of the religion business, all that was left was the sort of fundamentalist radio. So it's the, sort of the problem of monopoly. And the same thing is the case in publishing, in that the folks who were publishing the stuff that I'm talking about were Harper and Brothers, were Macmillan, were, you know, I mean, New York publishing. And still, that's largely because Harper won in San Francisco, right? And evangelicals went out and they said, we're going to create our own parallel empire, and did it with fabulous success. Well, that's true now, but they're smart enough to keep it separately branded and sort of really independent in a way because they understand. That, yeah.
Matt, wonderful work. I mean, this is I think an example of what I call move away from the textualism that has dominated the study of religion. I think this is the whole discussion about theology being a text about texts, right? And so the whole. I mean, I say in my book that there's a lot of good things about us really understand the importance of symbols and the importance of meaning in the way in which people relate to the world. But the idea that somehow you can use the text to understand everything, and so you say, well, the metaphor of the text is the way in which you understand practice. And what you're doing here is basically saying, no, it's practice that is the key to understanding text.
Yes.
In other words, you need to materialize the texts. Texts are material things.
Yes.
Rather than the material things are texts.
Yes.
And I think this is a wonderful way in which you could really address this issue of how theology, a new way in which you can understand theology. Now, have you read Katie Lofton's book on Oprah?
I've been following the book for a long, long time, and it's
that's part of the version where you're talking.
Yeah. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. So it's part of the not only just the kind of faceless American capitalism, but it's these are figures that have particular kinds of personalities attached, so that the books are connected to particular lifestyles and particular persons.
Yeah.
And Oprah spinning reading as a practice among other practices of consumption. Self-improvement, so it's part of a larger context, right, of reading. But I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm at the point of the book, which is weeks away from hitting the send button, that I'm trying not to read anything that will sort of, like, make me think, right? But Oprah, well, I'm teaching Theories and Methods of American Studies in the fall, and Oprah's on the reading list, partly because I'm like, I need to read it. So that's what better way to read something than to assign it, right? But, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I love hearing about reading, so I'm excited to hear about communities of people for whom reading is transformative. I feel like it's for me.
Mm-hmm.
But my question's pedagogical. I feel like every semester my biggest challenge is, my students are obviously functionally literate, but they really don't know how to read.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's teaching them how to read well. As someone who's not studying reading, how do you do that for your own students? What are your strategies?
Yeah, wow. I mean, yeah, that's really hard. It's not something I've done a lot of explicitly in the classroom. But, I think giving questions in advance or other kinds of things in advance so they kind of sort of have some points of entry before they just jump into a book, I try to do that. I bring my own books into class, and oftentimes I'll just do this, and I'll say, because I'm a scribbler and an underliner, I follow this advice, right? And just literally to show how I use a book, I often take notes in the back cover and just different things like that. So I kind of model that to a certain degree. But I don't know if I'm sure there are people who professionally know how to do this, who have much more wise things to say than I do about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
you can underline in even better ways, right? There are, for example, you talk about communities of readers. There are now ways on a Kindle and other kinds of things where you can join your Kindle in social networks so that you can see other people's marginalia and other people can see yours. So if you get your power of positive thinking there, and then you underline certain things, you can say 857 other readers have underlined the same passage, and then you can click and you can see what they have done with it or what kind of notes they have. So you can have these virtual communities of readers in ways that are even more sort of... Yeah, I mean, and I think that has to do...
It was actually 20 students.
At the university?
It wasn't a large... It was like one section out of a class.
Yeah, just as an experiment.
And those students complained. They were concerned that, yeah... They were concerned that somehow they wouldn't do as well on the exam as the students that actually had the book.
Mm. Well, the Charlottesville Public Schools, starting next year, they're replacing textbooks with laptops. Like, every student is going to get a little laptop. They're going to download the books. Nam gets this next year. It's in seventh grade.
I mean, I hate the idea as a reader because in my limited experience trying to read on the screen, I just can't do it, and I'm so habituated to reading pen in hand that I wouldn't know how to read keyboard in hand at all. For people who study reading, especially in the present, it's this incredible boon because it provides all of this data that's just not available in the past. Like I said, if you can get all of the marginalia for anybody who's ever read whatever book, I mean, if people who care about readers and reader response, that's nirvana. You know, people have used, like, reviews on Amazon, for example, as some window into readers.
But aren't they all 25-year-old white men? I mean, I'm not kidding. Like, isn't
the readers on...
Mm-hmm.
I would bet the Amazon readers would skew differently than the Wikipedia commenters, but somebody would need to study this.
Contribute.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something going on there with gender and class and privilege
sure.
That makes you think other people care about your opinion about that.
Yeah. Right. No, I'm sure that's right. I'm sure that's right. Yeah.
Serious religion, possibly theological works they are looking for. And we got a different response. Paul Eli, for example, mm-hmm. at SMG said, I really want to find the next Thomas Merton or Walker Percy or somebody like that. And made a real strong pitch for writers who are coming from their various religious traditions being unapologetically Jewish or Christian or Muslim and crafting narrative around that kind of specificity. Now, I haven't seen him actually publish many books of that sort. And if I named the books that he's published, they wouldn't meet those criteria. But, you know, when you look at the great public theologians of mid-century America, you know, Tillich's works and the Niebuhrs and translations of Barth and Bruner and the like, I mean, these are being published by Scribner's, by Harper, by
Macmillan, those would be the big three. Right,
all New York trade houses.
Mm-hmm.
So from your observation as a historian, you know, why is that kind of theological writing in trade publishing become so suspect, or theological writing has become relegated to, you know, particular theological houses? I mean, I have my own assessment of that, but I'd like to hear your historical view. And I'd like also to say, I wish there were more work done by historians with biblical training about the sort of formation of theological culture, you know, since the late 1960s. But it's my impression that's when that kind of generation ended.
Yeah. So, I mean, why the change from mid-century to late 20th century in the present is, I mean, that's a question, a huge question that has to do with the decline of the main line as and all the wonderful things that have come from the decline of the main line in terms of this hegemonic white Protestant, you know, establishment that has lost that privileged place. And so I think that is why, I mean, that's the big explanation for, that correlates. I mean, whatever other factors feed into that process, that's, the same story would tell us the story about the decline of the main line as would tell us the story about these transformations in publishing. Chapter 3 is about Harper. That's sort of what I focus on, and primarily on the sort of most important editor at Harper's in from the late 20s to the mid-60s. He was the religion editor there for that whole span of time, a man named Eugene Exmann. He published a lot of the German, you know, he published Richard Niebuhr. He published, I mean, there's this whole long list. He went to Birmingham to get King to publish some of his first novels. I mean, so he was very involved in that. He was also publishing books related to AA. He was publishing books in the 30s called Power of Constructive Thinking, which is even way farther out there than anything Peel ever did. This is stuff that, you know, sort of New Thought plus kind of Eastern ideas. These were, of course, sold much, much better than anything King ever wrote or Bultmann ever wrote or whatever else. His vision for the department, religion department at Harper's was let the market decide. I mean, it was this real, you know, we publish it and then you let market forces decide what works and what doesn't. Harper's a great story because in the late 60s, after Axman had retired and a new leadership was in place in New York, we get the God is Dead Time magazine. We get one of the editors goes out to San Francisco and hangs out at the Esalen Institute and is, you know, in the hot springs and the massage therapies and the whatever else, and says, in New York they tell us God is dead. Out here I see this incredible vibrancy of religious life. Went back to the folks in New York and said, we got it. I mean, look what's happening here. Look at the changes here. And the Harper Religion Department picked up and moved to San Francisco and became Harper San Francisco, right? So this is exactly the story that you're talking about, right?
Yeah. I would also say, I mean, I agree that the sort of collapse of an identifiable mainline Protestant culture is part of the condition of this, but I also think it has to do with shifts, methodological shifts, and whatever within theological studies. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
More conservative,
yeah.
Theory.
Yes, that's
no one wants to read that.
Right.
One thing you'll never hear a trade publisher say is this book needs more theory.
Right. 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 Whereas in mid-century, Tillich and Niebuhr were on the cover of Time magazine, yeah. And were on Mike Wallace interview shows and these kinds of things. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.